Teresa Mitchell. He's hosting Fight the Empire at 9. And then at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman interviews poet Robert Schlegel about his book In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. S.W. Konser has conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play and all of the internet fantastic activities and apps. If you'd like a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download the mobile app. Voices from the Edge next. That's the sound that I'm police.
That's the sound that I'm police. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th at the Dismantle Change Build Center in Portland. Alex Vitale, director of the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project, is the author of The End of Policing. He'll be speaking on how to reconstruct police culture and behavior and describe alternatives that remove the police from dealing with drug addiction, houselessness, sex work, mental health crises, and more. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th, 6 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center, 14 Northeast Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Watch out! We run New York!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Passport to Empowerment on Friday, October 18th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Vitalidad Movement Arts Center in Portland.
Passport to Empowerment will raise funds to support projects in rural communities and around the world to improve access to affordable and renewable energy, safe drinking water and sanitation systems, fuel-efficient cook stoves, and more.
Again, that's Passport to Empowerment on Friday, October 18th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Vitalidad Movement Arts Center, 116th Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Yes. This is E.D. Mondenay, president of your local NAACP, and I'm welcoming you to the show this morning. We're so glad to be here with you, and unhappy that Joanne isn't here, but I'm happy to be here with you today. Now listen, the FBI reported that anti-black hate crimes increased by 16% from 1,739 incidents in 2016 to 2,013 incidents in 2017. Hate crimes targeting black people represented 28% of all reported hate crimes in 2017. Now, every other racial and ethnic group also saw increases in the number of reported hate crimes in 2017. If you're looking at the news, and if you are a citizen of Portland, surely you know about the incident that happened at the DoubleTree Hotel, where there was a 34-year-old African-American man, Jermaine Massey, who was thrown out of the DoubleTree Hotel, where he was a registered guest, for speaking in the hallway on a cell phone to his mother. Today, as a guest on our show, is Jason Kafori. He's the lawyer representing Mr. Massey. And even though there's a lot of litigation that's happening, we can't talk about many things, but he's going to talk about so much regarding this case and maybe shed some light on it. Not only because it's an injustice done to one man, but also because it tells the story of what is still happening in our community, day in and day out. This isn't about singling out the DoubleTree. It's about making sure that this incident and thousands others like this just don't become normalized. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Edie. Thanks for having me on.
Man, I'm so glad to have you. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, you know, let's start just giving a quick overview of what happened to Mr. Massey. Guy is just an A-star client on all respects. He's a graduate degree. He's from Baltimore, graduate degree from University of Maryland. Worked for the FBI, worked for the U.S. Department of Justice, actually doing undercover civil rights investigations.
Wow.
So, I mean, he knows his stuff. Moved out here with his wife. They were living at the time in Kent, Washington. Never been to Portland, Oregon. This is his first night. Welcome to Portland, wow. Mr. Massey.
The whitest city in America.
Yeah, he decided to go to the Travis Scott concert at the Rose Garden, and he bought a hotel room at the DoubleTree. So he checks in. All was relatively normal. He comes back from the concert, and he gets a text or a call that he missed from his mom, and his mom lives out in Baltimore. So he's thinking to himself, this is very odd. It's 11 o'clock, you know, West Coast time and 2 a.m. her time. Something must be serious. Yeah. So he gets into the hotel DoubleTree lobby, and you guys, it's a huge place. I mean, it's a big, spacious, and there's a ton of people everywhere, almost all white people. And he goes into an area a little bit down the hall so he can have a private place to talk to his mom, and he starts having a very serious conversation about a health situation she's dealing with. Next thing he knows, he gets approached by hotel security guard Earl.
Yeah.
And Earl, you know, starts in a very threatening way, demanding, you know, what are you doing here? And, you know, he's talking to his mom on the phone, having a serious call, and he's got this guy...
While he's being policed,
he's being interrogated here all of a sudden. And he's and the security guard says, well, hey, you know, are you staying here? And he says, yeah, I'm staying here, and he shows the hotel key. Now, right there, this situation ends. Let's be real. As a white man in this city, no security guard would continue to interrogate me.
Yes.
It just wouldn't happen.
Yes.
If I said, yeah, I'm staying here, here's my... Yeah, he would walk away.
At that point, he walks away.
My bad, man. Yeah. I don't think he'd ever approached me to begin with.
Yeah.
But the security guard continues. Okay, well, what's your room number? And my guy's like, look, you know, I'm talking, I don't know the room off the top of my head. At the most that should have happened at that point is, sir, what's your name? Let me walk over and I'll walk over to the front desk, get this all straight. Now, that's still too much. That shouldn't have even happened in this situation. Yeah. Never should have been approached. He was not a... Instead, you know what they say? They say, well, you know what? You're a security threat. I'm calling the police on you.
Wow.
Security threat. Well, name one thing he's doing being a security threat, talking to his mom on a phone in a hotel lobby. So, fortunately, at this point, my client, being a smart guy, you know, he was working at Amazon in the human resource department at this time, gets out his phone. This incident never would have gone viral, never would have become a big deal if he didn't pick up his phone at that point and start documenting what happened. So he starts asking, why are you kicking me out? What's going on here? I'm a hotel guest. And the worst thing Earl says is, not anymore. You're not a hotel guest anymore. and that's when the cops arrive. My client has a very tense exchange with the cops. And he's marched through the lobby in front of everybody with two police officers and the security guard. There was no reason for the security guard to keep following him. I mean, you know, right. And so they go up to his room. He has to pack his entire bags. One of my favorite moments, my client took out the Bible from a desk drawer while he's packing his bags, and he slid it on the floor over to the security guard, and he said, "You should read this and learn some humanity."
Wow.
So powerful.
Now we've got the policeman and the security guard. Now we've got the judge, the jury, and the executors.
Yes.
Who are now...
We moved this into the litigation route yesterday.
Right now.
Now we can really talk about it. I couldn't talk about it much over the last 10 months.
Wow. But I mean, we've got the judge and the jury and the executors. Now we're looking at the Portland police becoming, you know, a part of this whole debacle.
Right. Well, I think... So, what happens... You know, he ends up getting marched out in front of everybody with his bag. Terrible, humiliating. And Mr. Massey will testify, and he said this. He has lived his whole life, predominantly African-American city, Baltimore, Seattle. Never once had any racial situation like this approach anything close to this.
Well, there's no city like Portland.
welcome to Portland, Mr. Massey. So, so what happens is he goes home. He's furious. Goes to a new hotel room. Has to go get a new hotel room.
Wow.
Films an Instagram video And that's what goes viral. His Instagram video.
Well, he's fuming at this.
He's fuming in this video. Yeah, and he's angry and he's frustrated. He did the number one best rule though throughout all this process. He kept his cool.
Wow.
And he was calm, cool, and collected. And so, next thing he knows, this goes viral. He contacts our law firm. It's a funny story. So this happens December 23rd. He had contacted us
2 days before Christmas.
2 days before Christmas, yes. Wow. Talking to his mom during the holidays.
Christmas. Merry Christmas.
So, you know, our office is closed 24th, 25th. I just happened to stop by my office on the 26th as we were closed that day also. And there was a blinking light for a message. I literally stopped by for 5 minutes to grab something off my desk. So I thought to myself, I'd seen this. This Massey thing was blowing up on the Oregon Live at this point. But I hadn't been retained. I didn't know that he was trying to contact us. And I just checked my voicemail, and it was him on the voicemail asking for help.
Well, he knew who to call.
He knew who to call. And So he came down the next day with his wife. We got to meet him in person. And we put out 3 questions to Hilton that they've never answered to date. Why was he first approached? Why was he interrogated? And why did you say he was a security threat? Name all the reasons those things happened. And Hilton's never answered those questions. They're going to have to answer them now under oath about what happened. And as a result of all that media, we got Washington Post, New York Times. We're up on CNN right now. It's up on Washington Post again today after we filed yesterday. So this story has caught the national attention.
Of course.
And we got flooded with the media back in December. We got flooded with people calling us from all over the country.
Yes.
Similar stories.
Yes.
African-Americans surrounded by white colleagues being approached, you know, do you belong here? Do you belong here? That sort of language from security guards. So what this was shown us is there's got to be a policy and a procedure. There's too much evidence now we've collected from around the country. And in the Oregon Live article, we highlighted 3 of the cases that were quite egregious, but those are a sampling of people that contacted us from around the country. And we are going to do 3 things through this litigation. Number one, we are going to find out every complaint that Hilton has received about racial targeting in their lobbies by staff and security. Because we're going to send out a request for production, and they're going to have to give it to us. We're going to get a judge to order it if they want to give us.
You're going to need to increase your staff.
We're going to have, we might get a lot. And so we're going to find out every complaint they had about racial discrimination before the Massey case. All 3 of the examples that I gave to the Oregonian, this was people contact, you know, professional people that worked with law enforcement, a woman who was in North Carolina to help put her mother-in-law into a civil rights North Carolina Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And she has the cops called on her. Her name is Dolores Corbett. She had to take her son and shield him because, as she told me, in Wilson, North Carolina, when the cops are being called on you, that's how kids get shot.
Oh yeah.
And she was scared, you know, beyond belief for her kid. As the cops are being called, cops are escorting her out, driving along with her down the road as she's leaving the hotel. I mean, horrible stuff. So, you know, Hilton, number 2, we're going to find out what was their policy. What was the policy? Did security guards have free reign to just walk up and ask anybody in a hotel? You know?
Well, this is America. This is the greatest country on the earth. And this is what democracy looks like. It is a systems and balance. It's a systems balance check and its procedures, etc. We need to know, and we need to be a part of those policies. We need to stand up and become a part. Let me tell you something. African-American men are under attack across this United States of America. And it's very important to do some things that you just mentioned. One of the things that we must learn to do, and it's very difficult to do, I'm an African-American man, obviously, and it's very difficult to stay calm.
Yes. You're angry.
Yes.
And you've had other similar circumstances, and it boils over. I totally get it.
Yeah. You know, I've been in situations recently where it has proven that when you stay calm and don't lose your composure. It's where your composure is where you get your greatest power. Listen, we're going to open up this conversation to those of you who want to be a part by calling 503-231-8187. Again, that number is 503-231-8187. Jason, if you had something to say to our audience this morning about the things, the steps that black men really ought to look out for and what they need to take with them, what would that be?
And I'd say black men, black women, all people of color, when you feel you're being racially targeted, because we do a lot of these cases, whether you're in a store or some other place of public accommodation, couple rules. One, if you can video the incident, that's gold, because video doesn't lie. So number one, you know, number two, get witnesses. People will fade and walk away from a situation. A lot of people don't want to be involved, but a lot of people will witness it and watch while it happens. And let me say, this is not just private security. This is with police officers also. I mean, these are rules for public safety officers as well. So rule number three, as you just pointed out, stay calm. You know, yeah. Be cool. Losing your temper, cursing, all that kind of stuff. It's a turnoff, sad to say, a year or 2 years down the road if we're doing a civil justice process and you're talking to a jury. Yeah. It just is. If you're cursing and yelling, so stay calm. Number four, get the names. The names of who's there. You know, a guy will walk up and he doesn't have a name badge on. You know, a lot of times these private security companies don't have well-labeled things. They'll just say security on it. And number five, and most importantly, don't just leave. You got to document the situation.
Yes.
Because we need to get video. We need to send a preservation of letters for incident reports. So go to the manager, file an incident report, and when you get that incident report, first thing you should do is contact a lawyer, because we need to get a letter out instantly. Those videos of the incidents, because they'll have surveillance videos everywhere nowadays. Those videos get erased after a week or two, so we need to get the preservation of evidence out.
Wow, it's unbelievable. Right here in our country, right now, today, that we are suffering these kinds of indecencies. Caller. Hey, Lou, how are you this morning?
I'm busy, but good topic, good guest. Good morning, Jason. Good
morning, Lou.
I don't think you mentioned it. You might have, but so far, I know you can't talk about details of the case, but is the target of the lawsuit so far solely, I guess, it's Hilton Hotel and the Portland Police, or just the hotel?
Good question. You know, we are only suing the DoubleTree and the Hilton. If the DoubleTree and the Hilton want to bring the Portland Police in as a third party, saying it's really their fault, that's up to them. You know, we had a long strategic discussion about this. To me, the Portland police officers were in a very tough position that day.
Yes.
A private company is using our taxpayer dollars to do their dirty work.
Yes.
They are asking the Portland police, they're calling 911, and they're asking Portland police to come there, and they're saying, this man is trespassing, force him to leave.
Yes.
The Portland police at that point, to me, they should have said, I think that this is crazy. I'm not going to enforce this because this is racist. I think that's what they should have done in this context, and I think that they've done some reflection on that. I know you've had some meetings with the Portland police involved with this case. But ultimately, the target here is DoubleTree and the Hilton, and predominantly Hilton, frankly, because the fact that this is a pattern happening at Hilton all over the country, and you know, when we undo the covers here, I want to find out what has Hilton done since this incident. And they put out some PR, as my dad called it on CNN, Don Lemon, when they first put out their statements. He called it corporate gobbledygook. They put out some statement, we've done training and we've done this and that. No. Specifically, what have you done? Lay it out. How much budget? How much staff have you added? You know, we're going to get the answers to that question. And if they haven't done much in the last 10 months, you know, a Portland jury is going to get to hear that.
Wow. Have you proposed any specific, like apparently maybe 2 years ago when Starbucks did a somewhat similar sort of thing with African-American customers, they then had supposedly a half day off for their own staff to be trained. Is that a proposal, or that's
you
up
know,
to Hilton?
It's up to Hilton. I'm not going to tell them how to do their job. There have been incidents like this all over the country. I think Starbucks did do a pretty serious effort, as I recall. I didn't look at the details, but I remember the media about it. But I'll tell you this, and you know, the ED here sitting with me, he tried to work with the Hilton. They rebuffed his efforts, and I think frankly, Hilton has treated this isn't our problem. This is a franchise issue. This is the DoubleTree's problem, not ours. That has been their attitude the entire last 10 months. And a Portland jury is going to get a chance, hopefully, to say that's not the case.
Amen.
Is there any, I was going to ask Edie, is there any, there probably isn't, but any evidence or I don't know, maybe it's just a philosophical connection. Edie probably saw the short story yesterday about Albert Lea in Willamette Week and Edie allegedly getting into an NAACP disagreement. I'm pretty sure Edie doesn't want to comment on that, but I thought I would mention as a Portland State person that Great Panthers is doing a series of forums, and I'll contact both of you offline in case you want to be speakers. Institutional racism is one of them. That's October 30th, the day before Halloween at night at PSU, Wednesday. And then there's a couple other ones with candidate forum for people who might be running, who are running for office. We've got six of them lined up. That a chance for people to ask questions about institutional racism, either police or private corporations. And then Ted Wheeler, finally, has agreed to come and talk the following one. So there's like three Wednesdays in a row. I'll try to let both of you know in case that first one, especially on institutional racism, seems like it might be relevant. Did you want to comment at all, ED, on the Willamette Week article?
Not at all. But we thank you for calling. Wow, racism is a problem in our country, and we've got to do something about it. And the only thing, the best thing to do about it is not to stop talking about it. We've got to lift it up everywhere we can, and we've got to address it everywhere we are. Listen, it's a problem. It's happening right now. It's happening today. We mentioned the police and their role in this.
It's complicated.
It is very complicated. And I tell you what, we have a very fine police system here. But this brings us to a point to where we understand that Oregon, especially Portland, has a opportunity to show the country how to get ahead of racism and how to deal with it, especially since we've been deemed the whitest city in America.
We are the whitest major city in America.
Yeah, and we can turn that around. We could talk about deliberately what we're going to do to fix it. We just celebrated at the DoubleTree Hotel removing the thorns of racism in the City of Roses. And the DoubleTree, I have to say, was very amenable to us. They gave us the room, and they were very conscious about throwing one black man out and us bringing about 500.
Did you tell them we were going to file the lawsuit a couple of days later after the event?
Well, they didn't. But I've got to tell you, they were in Portland style. They were very, very grieved by what happened, and they were looking very forward to making this hiccup, or more than a hiccup, this atrocity, this egregious behavior go away. We have a caller. Hey, Jason. And Jason went to sleep.
He probably called back. I will say one thing. You know, the DoubleTree is in a franchise agreement with the Hilton. The Hilton has full control. I'm going to get a copy, obviously, of their franchise agreement through this litigation. But most franchise agreements, you know, the franchisor, Hilton, has the ability to control all policies and procedures. They have the ability to make rules that all security guards have to follow. They have the ability to control who works there. I mean, they're very one-sided agreements generally.
Yes.
And so we'll get a copy of it, but I assume that's going to be the case here. You know, it's not DoubleTree Hotel. It's DoubleTree by Hilton.
Yes.
And I think when we look at what happened here, obviously these were DoubleTree employees involved. But I think they were following Hilton orders and policies. So that's what we'll find out through this litigation.
Well, one of the things that I do give them kudos for is they got rid of the security guard immediately.
Well, I wouldn't call it immediately. Let's actually go back in time and remember how this went down.
Okay.
Before Mr. Massey had an attorney, DoubleTree put out a statement saying, "The security of our guests is what's most important." Mm. Back to this when he was called a security threat, right? Mm. I don't think they would have gotten rid of that security guard and that hotel manager unless all this media happened.
Yeah.
So let's not put DoubleTree up on some pedestal here and say they got rid of him. No.
Okay.
What really happened they put out a statement initially, not apologizing. And saying security of their guests is what's most important, which is a veiled, he was a security threat by saying security of our guests is what's most important here. Then the media hits. Then they apologize and put the two guys on administrative leave on the Friday. And then on Saturday, they were fired. So, you know, corporations act because of public pressure and because that's how they're monetarily structured. And there's no doubt they took a, you know, Hilton took a national huge hit when this first went viral. So
you know, there are people who say he's doing this just to get the money. There are people who are saying, well, he created this incident to create this viral, catastrophe to bring attention to himself. Whether or not he did that or no, we have to understand that racism is real, it's happening, it's strong, and it's running terrorizing in our people in our country today. It's real, people, and it's something that we cannot just sit idly by and not address.
Yeah. I will say this. Mr. Massey is, I've met him. I've had several long conversations with him. He's just a great guy. He does not want any, he did not want to be part of some viral story. He's a very private person. He did not ask or want this to happen. He is doing this lawsuit, obviously for the pain and the emotional distress. Every time he goes into a place of public accommodation, despite all of his successes in life and all of his accomplishments, he views the world differently. After this incident, he always wonders, you know, am I on video? Who is someone following me? And why is someone approaching me? You know, it's changed the way he lives his life. And so he's been impacted a lot from this whole incident. But more importantly, you know, I think he realizes that there's a greater public good.
Yes.
In going through this litigation, you know, pulling the covers off of the big corporate giant to find out what's really going on under there. What are their policies? How many, you know, claims of racial discrimination in their lobbies do they have in their files? We're doing this for a public purpose.
Of course.
It's a public purpose. And, you know, I'll tell you a story. I think I may have told it to you the other day, but I'll tell it for these listeners. We had an African-American woman. She was in her 50s, very dignified, church-going woman named Brenda Moaning. And Brenda went into an H&M. It was their grand opening right when they opened up. And she was returning an item. And you know, we got the security footage. She's the only African-American in this store. Mm. For 2 or 3 minutes, that security guard up in the booth was following her on video everywhere she went in the store.
Wow.
As she leaves, she's grabbed, detained, taken to the back room for doing nothing. All she was doing was exchanging items. I think they kept her for 30 or 40 minutes. It was a really ugly, ugly scene. And we ended up taking that case all the way to a jury trial. Interestingly, Portland jurors, they have trouble finding situations where because of racial discrimination, they're much easier to say, yeah, that was a false arrest. They shouldn't have stopped him. They shouldn't have detained her. But it's much more difficult for Portland jurors to stomach the fact that there's racism in our city. And it's sad, but that has been our experience with trying a lot of these cases. So they found yes to the racial discrimination. They even found yes to punishment damages, punitive damages against H&M for what happened. And that story got so much coverage. The head of H&M, the CEO in Stockholm, Sweden, had to put out a statement talking about how they were going to do things differently at H&M. So doing this process changes corporate behavior.
Oh, yes.
And if you just, as my dad says, if you just go and say, you know, bad things happen to good people, I'm just going to lick my wounds and suck it up and move on with my life. If you do that, we're never going to change corporations. We're never going to make the situation better for our citizens and everybody else. So by coming forward, by calling out big corporations when they do this kind of behavior, you help make the world a safer, less discriminatory place for other people. I really believe that.
It becomes a platform to tell the story.
Absolutely.
And the story of what's really happening today. You know, I was in a hotel with one of my assistants just recently in Texas, and we were profiled and stopped by a security guard. What I did, however, was I led the security guard to the manager. And when we got to the manager,
you were a guest at the hotel.
I was a guest at the hotel. This happened to be a 5-star hotel. And
you just happen to be African American.
I just happen to be African American and well dressed,
as you always are.
Thank you, and a portly 60-year-old man. Okay,
clearly a security threat. Clearly a security threat.
So what I do is I lead the guard to his manager, and I ask the guard to explain to the guard that it wasn't cool for him to do what he was doing.
Right.
But unfortunately, this is something that happens over and over and over again. Racism is real.
Yeah.
We're in an environment where the highest office in the land is supporting this egregious behavior.
I think we are in a toxic racial culture right now, led by our, I'll call him puppeteer in chief, Donald Trump.
We have to be careful. He is our president.
Well, he is our president, and I invite him to tweet at me. I don't have a Twitter account, but he is stoking racism at levels that are toxic, and frankly, you know, what we saw with the shooting down in Texas, you know, in El Paso, where the guy gets in his car and listens to Trump manifestos and goes and shoots a bunch of Hispanic folks. You know, that's going to keep going, sadly, until we get Trump out of office and hopefully change the narrative of the Republican Party. So
we've got to remember that we are the people, and there's no greater power than we the people. And I know that that is very difficult to believe, but when you look through history, you see that nothing ever beats grassroots organizing and the people that are at the bottom. We're living in a different time. There is the new poor people are the blue-collar white worker, okay, that's used to privilege. So we're going to hear the groanings and the moanings of our nation a lot louder than we've heard them before. For 50 years, we've been silent on this issue, to wake up today and find that we've got a problem in our nation.
Well, let's not forget also, only 60% of us vote.
Wow.
You know, when you look at, you know, registered voters, I think the turnout in the last presidential election even was like 60-something percent nationwide. So, you know, I mean, we're not all speaking with our voice at the ballot box. And that's something that you know, I studied abroad in Brazil. In Brazil, you get fined if you don't vote.
Wow.
So they have very high turnout.
Wow.
In Brazil, and I thought that was an interesting concept. Yes, it's your civic duty to vote, but by the way, if you don't, you're facing a monetary fine.
Oh my goodness,
it's interesting.
You know,
right?
I think that that's something that we might want to explore. Listen, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. That's the number to call this morning. If you've been profiled, and if there's something that's really bugging you, and you want to talk about it, this is the time to talk. I think that we have seen the rise of a silent nightmare come to fruition, and others that had claimed for years not to be those kind of people, as you mentioned, your jurors always find it, well, people don't really think like that. We're not racist. Why is it so difficult to you, in your opinion, for white folks to understand that they're racist?
You know, why is it so hard to get a conviction against a police officer for shooting an African-American man?
Hmm.
I think that we psychologically, as people, want to feel safe. And if we feel that people around us are racist, if we feel that our police officers are not trying to protect us, it makes us feel subconsciously insecure, and it makes us feel vulnerable. And so I don't think people don't want to believe it. You know, they don't want to believe it. I was at a conference this last weekend. I missed the NAACP's event. I would have been there. I organized a legal conference, and we had...
Your cousin was there.
My cousin, Deborah, I'm assuming, is probably there, yeah. So we had Joe McMahon. He is the prosecutor who got the murder conviction against Chicago officer Jason Van Dyke for shooting Laquan McDonald in the back 16 times. And he gave a 30-minute presentation, went through the facts and the evidence of that case. You think we have power players in Portland politics? Woo! Try Chicago police. they had this. He told the whole story. It was a fabulous story. But you know, this is how the structure of power works. The police union immediately comes out and says, Laquan was attacking them with a knife, even though the video totally contradicted that.
Uh-huh.
It said, you know, he was dangerous. He was a threat. And the story kind of went away. And then you know what happened? The Cook County District Attorney, they knew what the video showed. The police knew what the video showed. Despite the public's request for it, They didn't release the video for 10 months. 10 months. And finally, the judge orders them to release the video. Mm-hmm. Release the video, and you can go watch it online. You know, the guy was walking away. Yeah, he was on PCP and he had a knife, but he's walking away. And the officer, within 6 seconds of arriving, has shot him 16 times and was actually loading his second clip before his partner stopped him from loading the second clip. So we got to hear this whole rendition of what happened. And it was a story about power. And it was a story about how difficult it is to get a jury to convict. And the courage, the courage it takes for a district attorney to take on a police union. As the DA said, he actually was from a more rural southern portion, because the Cook County, Chicago DAs were conflicted out because they had hid the video for 10 months.
Wow.
So he had to come into a whole new city, bring his team from southern Illinois, and he had to, you know, spend a year and a half preparing for trial and go through a whole month-long trial to get that murder conviction. And, you know, he said, you know, I had to address with that jury that race played a factor in that officer shooting. You know, he said, I had to up front talk to the jurors about that and make sure they knew that was a case I had to present. And he talks about how difficult it was for jurors. Sounds like we got a caller.
Good morning, Jason.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment about the importance of staying calm and composed when faced with, someone or some actions that are unjustifiable as far as authority or a public safety officer or police officer approaching a person. A lot of that is based on assumption on their part and not necessarily fact-based when they're approaching someone. So just if the person stays calm, it's very difficult to do. Of course, that's one of the most difficult things to do, to stay calm when you know you're right and they're wrong. But if you can do that, you maintain and you increase your virtue, and they end up decreasing and losing their virtue a bit. And in general, I think the public safety officers should not approach people at all based on assumption. Should only be based on facts. If it's based on assumption, it feels like harassment to the people. And I feel, just being in a public space, I've been harassed several times, meaning unwanted speech. Like, I was just doing my own thing in a peaceful way in a public area and had unwanted approachment or speech from public safety officers based on assumption. And it just bothers me. So I just want to say to people, if they could stay calm, that's the best thing, even though it's very difficult, and you will gain virtue from doing that. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Jason. It's extremely difficult to stay calm when you're being approached based on assumption, and you already amped, and you're an African American man, and you see all of this. You see the inequality all around you.
Yeah, it's hard to not boil over when you confront a situation.
It's
like this.
Very difficult to not boil over. It is important that we use the power of voting. What does voting do for us in the courtroom and for the jury?
Here's a good example. We have, for the first time, a contested district attorney race. There are several candidates running. I think everyone should do their own research. I've met with Mike Schmidt. He's a former Multnomah County District Attorney. He's a younger guy who he really wants to help change. He's against the death penalty, and he wants to stop having so many people go behind bars for low level drug offenses. That's a voting question, right? Voting for the right person to be your district attorney for the entire Multnomah County, that's going to determine who gets prosecuted.
Yeah.
And that's going to determine, what kind of a city we're going to have. And you got to remember, police officers charge. Police officers send criminal, you know, charges to the DA, but it's ultimately a DA's decision whether someone gets prosecuted or not. And so, you know, that's an example where voting's going to matter, and that's a primary election. That's going to be a May election to see, you know, if there's a top two, how that works out. So, you know, to me, I did want to address just the legal side of what your rights are when you're in a store, because I think that is important beyond just remaining calm. So if you're in a place of public accommodation such as a store, you know, you as a citizen, they don't have a right to stop and just randomly ask you, you know, did you pay for that if you've got a receipt? They don't have a right unless they have reasonable suspicion that you are actually stealing. And
if
so,
you have a receipt. Now, does that like stand to reason with the people that stand at the door at Walmart and asking you for your receipt as you leave the store?
Well, see, that's what's interesting. You know, Costco has a policy that, quote, everybody gets asked for a receipt.
Yeah.
Hard to say that's racist, but I know for a fact, I've got a case right now against Walmart, representing a client named Jamal Winchester, where he's walking out with a fishing pole, and he gets stopped and detained. And fortunately, his young kid was there and videoed the whole thing, so we have it.
Oh.
But there's a terribly unpleasant exchange with the security guard. He gets surrounded by six guys, and he's there for 10, 15 minutes. He'd bought the thing. In security, I've dealt with a lot of security professionals. There are called five, and I don't have them memorized off the top of my head, but there's five things you need to watch before it's a good stop,
okay,
to stop somebody. You need to see them enter the store. You need to see them take an item. You need to see them conceal the item. You need to see them walk by all points of checkpoints and exit the store. And you need to, this is the most important one. You can never lose eye contact with them from the moment they enter in, take the item, and go through. That's the 5 points of a good stop. And, you know, just if you don't have those 5 points, you don't really have reasonable suspicion. You don't know if the person grabbed something, put it in their coat, and put it back, for example,
wow,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know. So that it is a bad stop. Now, the shopkeepers, through our legislature, have passed the shopkeepers law, which gives them the right, if they have reasonable suspicion, to detain someone, but they have to do it in a reasonable manner and in a reasonable amount of time. So then it becomes a jury question, right? Like, all right, well, what's a reasonable manner? Is grabbing someone and throw them on the ground reasonable? I'd say no. You know, is politely asking somebody, hey, you know, are you stealing that item in your coat pocket? That's probably okay under the shopkeeper. Now, how much time, right? If you detain someone for 45 minutes, that's probably not a reasonable amount of time to get to the bottom of what's happening. Unless there's a whole bunch of video that has to be reviewed or something like that. If the exchange takes 30 seconds or a minute, you know, that's probably a reasonable amount of time. So if you have a question, if you feel like you've been stopped out there, you know, feel free to give our office a call, KaforiMcDougall.com, 503-224-2647. I'm happy to walk through the case with you and see if there was a case. I will say, we get dozens and dozens of calls about store false arrests or store racial profiling. We get them all the time. So it is a big problem in our city. And it predominantly, you know, sometimes for Latino folks or folks from Eastern Europe, but mostly for African-American folks.
You know, we're going to talk in a minute about the power of the district attorney and whether or not he has too much power, too little power, or how to take some of the wind out of the sail of that power. But we're going to go to a caller. Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, I had concern about, like many, about the use of deadly force by Portland police.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be no more tragic example of its misuse than the story of Nathan Thomas, which, if you haven't lived here long,
I remember that. I was in middle school, and Nathan Thomas, as I recall, was a sixth grader when I was an eighth grader, if I'm remembering the story correctly, from at Fernwood Middle School.
And he was held hostage by a deranged person, and the situation was, I mean, I would never, my heart goes out to the police officers, mostly the family, but I sent a letter after talking to a city council member who encouraged me to do this. I sent a letter to Daniel Outlaw saying, you know, this is a teachable moment. and she's new to the city. I wondered if, you know, my feeling is that the police were not well trained, and they were not well led, and that contributed to that tragedy. And I want to know that they are now well trained and well led, and that this episode in Portland police history, can be used as a teachable moment. I had two small kids in Portland public schools at the same at that time, and I had two small kids at that time, and it rocked the city. But the information was withheld. The parents never filed suit. It was devastating to the officers involved and everyone. But I still think it's a leadership issue, a leadership failure, a failure in training, and that teachable moment ought to be part of Portland police history, and it should be something. Anyway, I never got a response back from Daniel Outlaw or from any other city council member. Amanda Fritz is the one who encouraged me to send that letter to Chief Outlaw, but I don't know if it still resonates with me, and I just wondered if it was worth talking about, and I appreciate this opportunity to share.
Well, good for Councilwoman Fritz. We are in a democracy where there are systems of checks and balances. And believe it or not, you can bring litigation against the police. Isn't that right?
You can. For excessive force claims, absolutely. You have federal civil rights protections from excessive force, and we have state laws, assault and battery claims against police officers. They are very difficult. I have taken maybe five excessive force trials. I've been a lawyer for 10 years. I've done five of them. We have some of the biggest verdicts against the police. I think we have the biggest verdict in Multnomah County, over 560,000. And we have the third biggest verdict, I think 300-some thousand, against the Portland police for excessive force. So you can win. Both of those gentlemen, by the way, were white that had those excessive force claims.
Go figure.
I think I'll make two points on the Portland police. One is a positive, and one is something I think needs further work. On the positive side, when I started back in 08-09 as a lawyer, we would get at our office multiple calls a week for police excessive force from Portland. And I was almost all Portland police, not as much statewide police officers. So when the DOJ came in the Obama era, I think it was maybe 13 or 14, and they implemented the new policies and procedures, now a superior in the police has to come and document every use of force. Yeah. Every use of force has to be documented. And I have seen a dramatic drop over the last 3 or 4 years in calls about excessive force from the Portland police. So they are doing something right in terms of the really egregious stuff, the seven punches to the face and that sort of thing. I still think that the Portland police, especially with protests and demos, are too militaristic in how they do. They got all the riot squad gear and all this stuff. I think that's just a concept that I think about a lot. Firefighters are taught to risk their own life and limb to protect property.
Yes.
Portland police officers and police officers everywhere are trained to use, lethal force to protect themselves in a situation. And I've never understood why, if you have someone who's 20 feet away from you and they have a knife, why you shoot them through the heart? I've never understood that. Why don't you shoot the guy in the leg? And that's a training issue. That's 100% training. And they are trained, where do you aim? You aim to shoot with lethal force when you decide to shoot somebody. And that to me is something that, from the top down, whether that's the legislature or Chief Outlaw, that's something that should be reviewed.
Yeah. When we talk about public policy and procedure where it comes to the police, knowing that we are a democracy that supports systems of checks and balances, where is the best place to start for the normal voter to talk about what that looks like in the police system?
Well, let's not forget mayors are the one that select the police chief. The mayor in our city has the power. Now, it's a little different, at the sheriff at the county, Sheriff Reese, is elected, but the chief of police is appointed. So yes. Who we elect as our mayor is a pretty critical question. Because they generally, the mayor generally takes over the police department. That's been historically the pattern. So with your vote, who you pick as a mayor will determine police. I will say one thing about them. They are a paramilitary unit. They are a top down organization. So what happens at the top filters down. And that's always that's structurally how they're put together. You know, as a voter, we got a mayoral election coming up. Look closely at who's running and what they're saying about who they want to be running our Portland police and what they would do about police reform. I think that would be a really good question for, especially at forums, you know, mayoral debates, that kind of thing, as citizens to be educated on.
Wow. Caller.
Jane.
Hey, Jane. Welcome
Hi
to
there.
The show. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your show. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I just want to reiterate that, yes, we do need to keep talking about race because it is very deep-seated in our country, and it needs to be acknowledged and addressed. And just commenting on some of the ways that suggested how people handle injustice and when there's an unfair situation happening just even underpins a lot of racism, like remaining calm. Well, that's very important because as a person of color, if you don't remain calm and the cops show up, you could end up dead.
Yeah.
Documenting everything. Well, that needs to be done because if you're a person of color and it's your word against a pseudo-white authoritarian figure, you're probably not going to be believed. I mean, it's just even in handling a situation to document injustice underpins, I think, a lot of racism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think you're very right. The power in the district attorney.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of power. And it's a power. It's not an office that gets a lot of publicity,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, the mayor and the city council and the county commissioners get a lot of publicity for all their actions, but people don't really look at what is the district attorney doing day to day in terms of their charging of people. I can tell you one stat I saw the other day that really shocked me. Why is it that the district attorneys, our public defenders, are paid almost half of what a DA is paid? Isn't that crazy? I mean, the average DA was starting off at like 70-80, and the average public defender was starting off at like 40-45,000, something like that. That's not fair.
No.
Why should the DAs be getting paid double what the public defenders are getting paid, right?
That's not what democracy
looks like. They're both public figures. They're both participating. So that's a legislative problem, obviously, because
yeah.
that comes through the legislature. But you know, I will say that there has been an effort. I think it was Bloomberg has had a couple of very progressive district attorneys. There was a very progressive district attorney, for example, who won in Philadelphia recently in the last couple of years, and he's tried to change the culture of the DA. I think you're going to see a wave of more progressive district attorneys running for office over time. There was a guy who ran in Washington County this last cycle, and he did not do well. He was funded by some big outside money that was trying to have more progressive DAs run. But, you know, the DAs, kind of like the police departments, are somewhat of a good old boy network. And, you know, the DA who's more authoritarian in law enforcement will most likely get the endorsement of all the other DAs around the state.
Yeah.
So it's a cultural change. But I think it would be great to have a progressive DA elected here in Multnomah County as our biggest county, because that would send a message to the rest of the counties in the state that things are changing.
And that election is coming up really soon.
Yeah, May, absolutely. So go look at that.
We have to look at, if you're not registered to vote, I think you need to be registered, and of course you do, and especially if you're young, gifted, and black. If you're old, gifted, and black. Well, if you're middle-aged, gifted, and black, it's a good idea to get registered to vote. We have a caller. Hey, Joe.
Hey, really great conversation, powerful story, and I'm really inspired by your vigilance on the issue. I know that KABU was sponsoring an event, a couple events this weekend about, as the title goes, imagining and creating a world beyond policing. And There's an author, Alex Vitale, coming out from New York to speak at both of those events. He's the author of a book called The End of Policing.
Yes.
And on an interview last week, he was talking about his book and number of issues. And one of them is, you know, he talks about how in recent years, Black Lives Matter and related movements have brought attention to intense, egregious cases of racism and police brutality. But what he thinks is kind of the real fundamental thing that's the corrosive factor is the, like, extensive over-policing. And he, you know, talks about, like, low-level offenses bringing people into the criminal justice system. And I just am listening to your case and to your client's story and, like, wondering where that fits in, because I noticed how you pointed out that, like, the Hilton is, you know, calling the police and wasting taxpayer money. But it's kind of like, you know, the police exist, some would say, for the purposes of property owners to have them do just this. And I'll take my comments off the air, or your response off the air.
Well, you know, I think the police serve a lot of useful functions. I think we do need a police force. I believe in a police force that is not militaristic, that does not have all this former, you know, military equipment. You know, I mean, in the UK, we used to have officers without guns for hundreds of years until very recently. So, if you get, and there's also, you know, there's, I believe in community policing. I believe in having the police live in the community. I saw a stat a few years ago, something 70% of our Portland police force didn't live in the city of Portland.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so you have people commuting in here that aren't living there, don't know the neighborhoods, don't know the people. I think that we need to return to a place where police are there to help people, not to be a paramilitary force. And, you know, it's really hard. I will tell you this. The Portland Police Union is one of the most powerful entities in this city.
Yes, it is.
And any change. I mean, yes. I know, for example, the NAACP and Joanne Hardesty and others have been leading an effort to work on the contract, you know, the police union contract. For example, why do police get 48 hours off before they have to be interviewed when there's a fatal death shooting, right? An average citizen doesn't get 48 hours off to get their story straight before they're interviewed, right?
Right.
And there's lots of examples like that. And I'll tell you the one that's most egregious to me, and this is the one that really burns me. We had former Chief Rosie Sizer in a deposition on an excessive force case, and my dad asked her under oath, "Are you aware of any Portland police officer who has ever lost their job permanently as a result of excessive force on a citizen?" She said no. And I think that's true, because even Frashauer, who shot Aaron Campbell in the back, he got his job back through arbitration. So, you know, we have an arbitration system, and I believe in unions. I'm a big, strong union supporter. But we have an arbitration system that if someone is fired by the mayor for excessive force, they get to go through arbitration to get their job back, and the arbitrators throw their hands up and say, well, there's no precedent for ever firing someone for excessive force in the arbitration system, therefore we can't do it. Well, that's just wrong. That's just wrong. So that's the kind of thing that through citizen outrage, through organizing, we can put pressure on the city to fix in that next upcoming union contract with the Portland Police. And I believe that contract is up in 2020 and is being renegotiated as we speak. And by the way, I know Joanne fought hard on this. Those contracts, those discussions should not be happening behind closed doors.
No.
That should be a public, the public should be participating in that police union contract.
And you have a right to voice your opinion, and you need to know beyond any shadow of a doubt that your voice does matter. I tell you what, silence is never golden when it comes to being able to articulate the problems that facilitate danger and that facilitate racism in our communities. There are dangerous times for our communities that we're living in them, and this is a present proof of that. We want to thank you for listening today, and we need you to remember something, that united, we have the power to confront the forces of hate by celebrating the fundamental dignity of every human being, and by using our voices to demand that our city live up to its highest ideals of fairness, diversity, and inclusion. Jason, we are so thrilled that you're on top of it and that you and your family have been famous and infamous.
The Portland police find us infamous sometimes, I'll tell you that.
Well, when you're fighting for justice and when you're fighting for freedom, you find that you have enemies that that you know not of. As we get ready to exit this show, I want to know, your last words to us, Jason, is what?
Stay tuned to this Massey case. It's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out. It put an ugly scar on our city, made viral all over the world, and we're going to get to the bottom of what did Hilton do, what have they changed, and what they're going to do down the road to make people feel safe in their lobbies.
Thank you. Listen, I'm E.D. Mondenay. Stay tuned tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m. for Removing the Thorns on YouTube and our Facebook. And until then, we want to thank you for joining in, and we're encouraging all of Portland to stay strong.
Stay strong.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Fight the Empire with Per Fogering.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon in Portland. 10 Spiders play bluesy roots rock and will be releasing their third EP that night. They'll be playing with Eco Check, an indie alt rock band, and Flying Caravan, who plays psych folk. Again, that's the 10 Spiders third EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon, 836 North Russell Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon in Portland. 10 Spiders play bluesy roots rock and will be releasing their third EP.